Buongiorno tutti. Yes, welcome to Venice and our very special edition of Film Weekly from the 66th Venice Film Festival. I'm Jason Solomon, sitting on the terrace of the famed Hotel des Bains here on the Venice Lido. It's where Visconti shot Dirk Bogarde in his version of Death in Venice. And stirring the calm blue lagoon around the Venice Lido is Oliver Stone with his documentary South of the Border about controversial Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez, who turned up on the red carpet in the considerable flesh. I speak to a bullish Oliver Stone about making the documentary, filming Wall Street 2, and why America is obsessed with war. More of that exclusive interview later. My old friend Zan Brooks is here, and we punt our way through some of the other big films premiering at Venice 66, including Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story, and a new one from Steven Soderbergh. Yes, pop the Prosecco, mix the Bellinis, stir up the polenta and put squid on top. It's a Venice Film Weekly. Before we plunge into those waters, however...
What should I do, you think?
About what?
I don't really want to go back into government work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but shouldn't I find something to do? These wives don't do anything here. That's not me. It's just not me.
I know.
I saw a notice on the bulletin board at the embassy for hat making lessons.
You like hats?
I do.
No. What is it that you really like to do?
Eat. I know.
And we are so good at it. Look at you. Now,
how growing
good you
in
are.
Front of you.
That's Meryl Streep as Julia Child and Stanley Tucci as her loyal husband, Paul, in a scene from Nora Ephron's latest feature, Julie and Julia. Efron's previous credits include writing When Harry Met Sally and directing Sleepless in Seattle, two romantic comedy classics that bestride the genre. Now she turns to Julia Child, the pioneering food writer, chef and American TV personality, played with brilliant comic bravado by Meryl Streep, and weaves her story with that of a novice blogger, Julie Powell, played by Amy Adams, who rustled up a recipe from Julia's French cookbook every day for a whole year. Two women's stories exploring the liberating forces of cooking and writing through different generations. When I met up with Nora Ephron, I began by asking her, as a writer, how much of herself ends up in her characters, particularly in Julie and Julia.
I think quite a lot in both of them because that isn't to say that they are me, but I am I'm a passionate cook, and I learned to cook from Julia Child's cookbook and had an immense imaginary friend relationship with her that Julie Powell also had. Mm. So it's not that I imposed my own biography on hers. It just was an overlap that made it very comfortable for me to write.
And is that what you do when you're writing your characters? Do you imagine them as friends? Are they sitting next to you on the desk?
No.
No,
they're right. They're on, in the computer. They're somewhere inside the computer.
Because they are. Yeah. I mean, if you think of that, the great characters that you have kind of ushered into life, including, I suppose, these two are kind of life did it for you in the meantime. But they're your versions of these characters, and your Meg Ryan character, and your in both You've Got Mail and Sleepless in Seattle, and I'm thinking of your Harry Met Sally characters,
yeah,
as well, that you brought them into your life. Where
well, Sally is very, very much like me in many horrible ways.
Everyone likes Sally. People fell in love with Sally.
Well, I know.
That's your...
But not all waiters fall in love with Sally. Let's make that clear.
That wasn't you at Katz's Deli.
No, that wasn't me. I don't mean that. I just mean the way she orders. The particularly insane, finicky way she orders, mm-hmm, is me.
Yeah, you so. Have that's also reflected in Julie and Julia. There's a scene where they all order a Cobb salad with
yes,
differences.
Well, that's true of anyone ordering a Cobb salad. Everyone gets turned into that person with a Cobb salad.
It's interesting because...
Do you have Cobb salads in England?
We're not so Cobb salad. I always know I'm looking at a New York movie where people kind of are talking about variations on Cobb salads as well.
That's right.
We get a lot from American movies. But I wondered how much you got from the movies itself. I mean, in, of course, Sleepless in Seattle, it's probably your biggest quote that you've done from a movie because they meet up because of An Affair to Remember.
That
plays
right.
the sort of biggest movie role, I think, in all of your films. But you grew up in the movies, so I wondered if that was, you know, how they kind of informed your early life.
Well, I think my early life was more informed by books than by movies, which is not to say I didn't go to the movies every single Saturday and see two movies. And I loved them and I remember them, but my imagination was mostly taken with books growing up. I was just a voracious reader and I have a lot of children's books still.
When you mentioned When Harry Met Sally, because you wrote that, but you didn't direct it.
No.
Was there, and there's a line in Annie Hall where he sort of turns to camera and says, God, if only I had the guts to do my own material, because he's writing for a bad stand-up. Was there a moment for you like where you thought, well, like, you know, I've given this to Rob Reiner and he's made a beautiful, beautiful movie, but
well,
it's
when
mine.
I wrote When Harry Met Sally, it was a movie where I thought, I could probably direct this, because there were only two people in most of the scenes, or four, and there were a lot of walls. I like walls. I would rather be in a room than outside. And then Rob did such a good job of it that I thought, well, I couldn't have done it that well, so, and look how lucky I got. But then my first movie was a movie about a woman who becomes a stand-up comic and has two kids, and it's all about that whole dilemma.
It's called
This Is My Life.
It'd be 1992.
And, you know, who was going to direct that movie? There were very few women directing movies. Most men don't want to direct movies that aren't about them. And, well, that's just true. Most directors don't want to direct movies that aren't about them because it takes a long time, and you have to find some way of it feeling personal. Yeah. So when I was writing that movie to direct it, that was when I just thought, I've got to become a director. And I also felt that I had to protect my writing because as you know, the movie business turns on you at a certain age if you're a writer, but if you're a director, you can kind of get an extra 10 years or so out of the business. So it was almost that if I became a director, at least I would have a director.
So did you learn directing? Was it something you saw what someone did with your script? And
well,
then...
I got to watch Mike Nichols direct Heartburn and Silkwood. He let me be there. And then I watched Rob direct When Harry Met Sally. So I felt that I sort of knew something. But then it turned out I didn't know anything. I'm totally mortified at how stupid I was for my first few movies. Now I know quite a lot more.
Yeah, do you think now that your craft is... Because I must say one thing about Julie and Julia. I mean, you've always had these sort of double things going on. It's Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks, or it's...
That's right.
You like a sort of... Like a twin tower thing going on, or plate spinning exercise. In Julie and Julia, I have to say that the editing, maybe you've just hired a very good editor this time.
I do have a good editor.
This one keeps those two spinning very, very well. I really enjoyed the way that the two stories are meshed together.
And the music also
is that, does. Have you learned to do that better?
I hope so. But what I mean, my first movie, I knew nothing. I really didn't even know that the camera could like move upwards, that you just had to build a little ramp and it could go up it. I had no idea. I just wasn't focused on that. All the movies I'd watched as a writer. And so I was very careful. I felt I was there as the writer, protecting that little slice of the pie. And the point is that I wasn't watching the other stuff as much as I should have. Now I've learned a lot.
Right. Nora Ephron, okay. Absolute delight to have you. Okay. Fascinating insight into both of your arts. And congratulations on Julie and Julia. And thank you for coming in the director's chair.
Thanks. This was fun.
Julie and Julia is on release back in the UK from Friday, the 11th of September. And you can catch more of Nora Ephron in video form as the latest subject in my In the Director's Chair series, as ever, by going to guardian.co.uk/film. I've joined up with Zan Brooks, as I said I would last week. We're going to chew the fat over a few of the films that have graced the opening days of the festival. Zan, how's it been for you?
It's been a very nice festival. It's such a nice contrast to Cannes, isn't it, Venice? It's much more low-key and slightly ramshackle, I guess because it's all in development. There's all sort of the building site going on, which actually makes it feel much more casual and just easygoing.
Yeah. I mean, the films are still quite big. Last year, Venice was suffering from a sort of lack of kind of confidence, I think, and it lost out to Toronto. But this year, it's kind of seized that high ground back with a few kind of quite high-profile visitors and premieres, including John Hillcoat's The Road, which many are kind of touting to go on to Oscar glory.
Yeah, The Road was a film I approached with some trepidation. One, because I know what it's about and it ain't pretty. And two, because the book was such a kind of monumental work that there's the old adage about, you know, good books making bad films. And yet I think that John Hillcoat did a very good job with it, and it also boasts a really superb performance. The more I think about it, the better it gets from, I think, Viggo Mortensen as the unnamed man who leads his son basically on a road to nowhere through sort of post-apocalyptic America. And fascinatingly, you know, because the film is basically saying we're all already kind of halfway down the road anyway. Fascinatingly, there's no kind of CGI in this film at all. It was all shot on real American locations of today, whether that was the suburbs of New Orleans, you know, that's still kind of blighted by Katrina, or what they call the abandoned Pennsylvania Highway, or kind of ghost towns in sort of Pittsburgh and around there. And that really gives it a kind of terrifying resonance.
Does it give it a political resonance, or is it just a kind of allegorical post-apocalyptic kind of resonance?
I think it is an allegory, and it's weirdly a kind of quasi-religious allegory, because it's the father is almost like the Old Testament figure, and then he's got this sort of the saintly son who maybe is the way of the future. So it's not going for obvious political points here, but at the same time it's hard not to see it as a possible harbinger of things to come.
So that's been early on in the festival, and I suppose the next big one was Todd Solondz was back for the first time for quite a long time. His new film, Life During Wartime, also sounds a bit of a political, a bit allegorical. I gather we're back on sort of the ground that Happiness trod in New Jersey all those years ago.
We are exactly back there. Life During Wartime is a sequel to Happiness, his film from 10 years ago.
That's officially so, he said that.
Well, it's a kind of quasi-sequel, because what he's actually done is he's got all the same characters but played by different actors. So although it's nominally 10 years ahead, some of them seem to have aged more than others. And this is a typical kind of Solondz thing. He's always been somebody who treads his own course. And so he's never going to do something as crass as make a sequel. And yet it's... Where Happiness, I think, was like a kind of bomb going off, Life During Wartime is kind of sifting through the wreckage and giving a kind of report on the casualties. And if anyone who's seen Happiness knows that it was a real car crash of a film, and this does chase up those characters.
Stylistically a car crash, I mean just emotionally a car crash, because it was a kind of an amazing film as well.
Oh, I loved it, yeah. It was a brilliant film. But it was showing a fairly unpleasant side of human nature and kind of snickering at it and laughing at it. And this film doesn't really laugh at it. This film maybe is the work of an older, wiser man.
It's an interesting return to Venice for Todd Solondz, and I look forward to catching up with that. Is it a film that's likely to have a life beyond the festival circuit? It's built such a good cast, doesn't it?
I suspect it doesn't, unfortunately. Happiness was a sort of punch to the gut. It really stirred up people. It whipped up a response. It was possibly, you could even say, it was the most controversial movie of its year. This isn't going for the same kind of pushing buttons, and therefore is maybe destined to be seen as a bit of an afterthought, but it's still well worth seeing.
Okay, that was Todd Solondz's life during wartime. When I spoke to you last week, when I was in London, we saw there was a kind of a clash of the titans in the offing. Werner Herzog was in town with his remake of Abel Ferrara's Bad Lieutenant. Now, the Herzog version is called Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. And then Abel Ferrara's in town tonight, as we speak, with Napoli, Napoli, Napoli. Now, I said, who is winning a fight between Herzog and Ferrara? Let's start with the film itself. Who's won in a fight between on remaking Bad Lieutenant? Has Herzog supplied a bit of madness to the original, which was quite mad already?
He has. He's supplied his own particularly Austrian strain of madness, I think, to this. You know, this was actually the surprise of the festival for me, because I went in thinking, this is going to be a disaster. I don't think Herzog made a good dramatic feature for quite a long time. His documentaries are still great, yeah, but his drama features are not. And he's remaking a film that, whether you love it or you hate it, is an important film, and a significant film, and a film with its own identity. And I really thought he's gonna kind of louse this up so badly. And yet it's great. It's really, really good. It's totally different from the original. It doesn't have Ferrara's, that sort of dark marinade of sort of Catholic guilt and, yeah, blood and semen and all these kind of evil sort of forces in there.
Damn, because I was looking forward to that.
But instead it's almost like an espresso whip of neuroses and angst and cocaine. And it stars Nicolas Cage, who again, you know, I was trepidatious going into it, but he gives one of his best performances in a long, long time.
Does that mean it's also one of his kind of most off-the-wall and maddest, unhingest performances?
He's right back to Wild at Heart territory here. He is the bad lieutenant who is up to his neck in gambling debts and basically drug busting and then taking the drugs for himself, and is prone to sort of laugh at the most inappropriate things, and is just completely off the wall, and then he's hallucinating iguanas, so occasionally you get these kind of very strange little motifs of these two iguanas where Herzog apparently put the camera in a little fiber optic cable and pushes them right up against the iguanas' faces, and it's really odd. And I guess on one hand you could say it's a straight police procedural thriller, and yet it's so not. It's so away with the fairies and out there.
Eva Mendes is one of the stars as well. She got a lot of kind of red carpet attention when I was back in London. You could see it was like Eva Mendes arriving. People aren't interested so much in the Herzogian kind of flourishes, rather on the kind of Alberta Ferretti flourishes that she sported on the red carpet. Has Venice had a bit of glamour?
Venice has had a bit of glamour. Not certainly not at sort of Cannes level, but we have had Eva Mendes around. We have had Tilda Swinton here. We have had, the parade of various Hollywood big shots coming over. I don't know if does Pixar count as glamour? It doesn't really, does it? We've had the geeks from Pixar in to get a Lifetime Achievement Award.
That's true, isn't it? That's been the glamour this year. John Lasseter's Hawaiian shirt and a big Buzz Lightyear. But then, you know, it's all cinema. Zan, I've joined you now for Venice, and I've happened to now catch up with a couple of films that you were telling me to see. Let's start with Claire Denis' White Material. I'm a big fan of Claire Denis at the moment. I think she's on a kind of amazing run of form with 35 Shots of Rum, which is still, I think, available in England, and sort of is kind of heading up my list as my film of the year at the moment. Of course, there's a lot of good films to come, and one of them is Claire Denis' new film White Material, which premiered here. I've seen it, and I thought it was terrific, another terrific piece of work from her.
She's absolutely brilliant at conjuring up this sort of sweaty existential angst. And this is a film that just has a sort of danger to it. I mean, the subject matter is dangerous. It's Isabelle Huppert as the who's running a coffee plantation in Africa, where at a time when all the white farmers are being forced off their land, and there are both rebels and militia hiding out in the woods, and you can't really trust either side. So, you know, this is territory that's ripe for drama, but she certainly brings something extra to it. This isn't a kind of Hotel Rwanda story. This isn't even a sort of scaremongering poor white farmers with the evil blacks kind of closing in, which at times it possibly could verge on, but she keeps it opaque and mysterious and strange and frightening.
There's a bit of white guilt involved. There's a bit of breakdown. I think it's a kind of character study, brilliantly played by Isabelle Huppert, I thought. Muscular kind of determination to hold on to this dream, which might be Africa on a wider scale. Claire Denis often made films about Africa, North Africa, or Chocolat, which was more equatorial Africa. But There's no director around at the moment who kind of conjures up the sense of place and transports you to that world in about three or four camera moves. She did it in 35 shots of Rum. I was right in that apartment. And here I was straight into that coffee plantation. In about 3 minutes, I was totally immersed in her world. Having got off the boat myself, gone straight into the screening here in Venice, I was suddenly in Africa. And I think that's an amazing skill for a director, really at the top of her game.
Yeah, and she is at the top of her game. It's interesting looking at the trajectories of directors, and it's almost they catch you unawares, and I think suddenly now there's a sense that Denis is at the top of her game. She's right there, and this is a fine film at the festival.
Another person, a director who I've had my eye on for quite some time, is an Austrian director called Jessica Hausner, whose debut film Lovely Rita really took the eye, and I've missed her film here, but I gather Lourdes has been one of the most agreed on as a kind of a critical success. She's a director I've sort of touted for good things. Is this her good thing?
I haven't seen Lourdes either. I've missed it too, and yet I've heard exactly the same things as you. This is always one of the dangers of the festival, that you kind of pick what you want to see and often you get it wrong. Like, I went to see The Informant. That was kind of rubbish.
Steven Soderbergh?
This is Steven Soderbergh's anti-corporate thriller. It's his kind of anti-Aaron Brockovich, where he plays it as fast, and it's Matt Damon as a whistleblower who turns out to be kind of blowing raspberries, really. And it should be funny, and yet it was so lazy and smug and self-satisfied and broad.
So in the Soderbergh canon, where you say it's near Aaron Brockovich, it sounds like it's kind of got a bit of liminess to it.
No, the limey had a kind of edge. The limey was strange. This isn't strange. This is sort of complacent and flabby. This is like kind of one of the Ocean's films without the big star muscle.
Without George Clooney and Brad Pitt, just with Matt Damon.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't work.
Might as well. I'm not looking forward to his London film with just Don Cheadle either. Interesting you say it's his anti-corporate film, because I suppose one of the big films here, and certainly one of the big entrances, as he's always going to make, is Michael Moore, a former Palme d'Or winner, now looking to win the Leon d'Or here at Venice with his new film, Capitalism, A Love Story. I've just come from the public screening of it, catching up with it, where it received an extraordinary ovation. I mean, people were cheering from the rafters, like the populace of Rome sweatily throwing their garb into the air and beneath the new emperor of a new kind of loving form of capitalism. It's an extremely emotive kind of piece of work. 2 hours of politics, but actually riveting.
It is riveting. It is, you know, again, I was thinking, really, can he do this again? Yeah. You know, Bush has gone from the White House. Who has he got to target? But then thankfully, there was the marvellous bank bailout of $700 billion of taxpayers' money going to the banking CEOs, thanks to Hank Paulson in the Treasury, who's an ex-executive of Goldman Sachs. So there, Michael Moore has his target again. And in a way, maybe he's always going to have the target, if that is the target, because the target is American capitalism. And American capitalism that he paints as a sort of philanderer that basically rips off the public, lines the pockets of the few at the expense of the many, and is fundamentally, he argues, unchristian and un-American. It's not constitutional.
An amazing kind of strain of religion running through it. When we go back on his past, as he was brought up, he wanted to be a priest, he confesses in this film, and he was a strong Roman Catholic. But then he also goes back over Roger and Me, and I guess over Sicko in a way. And there's this strain of kind of moral uprightness that runs through his work. And so many people in America seem to be Michael Moore enemies. He tells us about his own enemies in films like Sicko and Fahrenheit 9/11. But actually, this film seemed to be kind of trying to curry favour with the religious strain that runs through America and against the evil now perpetrated by these kind of, you know, vultures at the top.
There's, for all of his sort of bumbling crudities and his simple moral universe, there is a genius in his populist argument. Because basically, he is saying this is un-American. You know, the whole argument that they use against Michael Moore is you're a communist, you know, go over to Russia if you like, living over there. You know, all of that rubbish. And he turns it on its head and undermines the whole argument of American capitalism very subtly at times. And it's brilliantly done. And also, it has to be said, he is superb. Either he or his researchers are great at getting the human stories behind this vast hydra-headed beast. So there are brilliant. There are sort of like little 10-minute snippets in this film that would make great features themselves. There's the one that really chilled me was the private detention centre in Pennsylvania, run with the help of a local judge who basically just shoving kids in and then charging the taxpayer for their incarceration.
An extraordinary story.
Stories. You know, these kids, 6,000 kids are basically put into this thing for infractions like you know, slagging off their vice principal on a MySpace profile or throwing a bit of meat at their mother's boyfriend. And they're in jail for it.
He's also very good at going into the homes of kind of normal America. So we see all the kind of cheap wooden furniture, all the kind of cereal boxes and their kind of honey pots. And then we see the sadness of their stories, which are either the death of a mum whose company is insurers of Walmart are raking in because they've put an insurance policy on their workers, calling them dead peasants. I mean, layer by layer, the film is, as you say, populist, but extraordinary in its kind of human touch. And I mean, I thought this with Sicko as well. He's like some sort of inflatable Condide, kind of wandering around wide-eyed, but actually knows exactly where his film's going and leaves the reveal right till the end.
And the other thing that has to be said about this film, we're painting it as a very bleak autopsy of America, but it's also an incredibly hopeful film. Mm. You know, there is, for one hand, there's the sense of things may be changing under Obama, but then this is sort of percolating through to the workers who have a sit-in at their factory and win. And then there's the great thing of the sheriff who refuses to carry out any more home repossessions, with the logical argument that if $700 billion has been given to the bank, surely the bank then is obliged to pass some of that down to their clients who are themselves struggling. So therefore, he is not repossessing any more homes.
And this leads to the wonderful and traditional now Michael Moore grand stunt, where kind of like the artist Christo, he kind of wraps Wall Street in crime scene tape, which is just amazing and works absolutely brilliant as a kind of image. I thought, you know, it could well, it's so emotive and so popular here in the casino here built by I suppose what was the ideal was a kind of socialist regime that in Italy implemented this, it might carry off the big prize.
I hope so. And there's another great bit where he's on Wall Street and he shouts at some trader who's coming out, I just need some advice, and the guy says, don't make any more movies. And you think, you're right, because this is the movie they really don't want to see.
Zanbrook, lovely to see you here in Venice. You've got to go back. I'm going to stay and see a bit more like Men Who Stare at Goats. Wait George Clooney to come in. I'll send him your love. But if not, I'll see you back in London. Arrivederci, ciao, e molto grazie.
Thanks very much, Jason, and enjoy.
Now, as I sit on the terrace at the Hotel des Bains, just missed Tilda Swinton going by. I've seen Sophia Loren here this week, and I've seen Ang Lee. I've also seen Michael Moore. Now, he's usually the director poised to stir up controversy of a political kind at festivals like this, but this year, I think he's been matched, at least, by his fellow American director, Oliver Stone, when he premiered his documentary South of the Border about the much-vilified president, some say dictator, of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez.
Who is Hugo Chavez? Where did he come from?
He was literally born in a mud hut and grew up in poverty. And this affected his view of Venezuela, as well as ultimately his lifelong mission to transform the country.
Chavez himself even turned up on the red carpet, blowing kisses like a Chinichita starlet. Well, when I met up with Oliver Stone in the Grand Ballroom here at the Hotel des Bains, I found him in fighting form, mounting a plea for his film about Chavez and the Venezuelan leader's politics to boot. I started out by asking Oliver Stone, after his 2003 documentary on Cuba's Fidel Castro, what drew him back to Latin American leaders in the dictatorial mold.
I'm doing this with my left hand. I'm making features. I'm a dramatist. I went to see Castro, and I think that he got a raw deal. You know, for you know, America attacked Cuba. America imposed the embargo. Cuba did not attack America. So it's always this. I'm concerned about American foreign policy, and I'm concerned why my country, since I was born, seeks out enemies. I was in the World War II generation, born 46, and all we've done since I've been born is everywhere we have Cold War. We've been war on drugs, the war on terror, and I wonder something is. I feel like I'm brainwashed in my country. And Iran, South Vietnam, North Vietnam, Venezuela, Hussein. I made the point that Hussein was a monster that we created. He was a dictator. He did bad things. But my God, he was in collusion with us. All these Frankensteins around the world. Where does it come from? We empower them. And all the information on Hussein was that false media And the media in America is ashamed, should be is disgraceful, because they pass this information to the people, and the people who are on television is for profit in America. It's never state-owned.
Why are you unmasking this situation then?
Because it's destroying the fabric of our country. People are operating on false information. The consequences are enormous. Not only war, murder, death, people who are dying in Iraq, Afghanistan, the war on terror. I mean, we recently put 7 new military bases in Colombia, in our secret war in Colombia on drugs and on terrorism. Colombia is going to be another Afghanistan, maybe another unwinnable war. These are big issues. My country does this over and over again. That's what concerns me. I'm American.
So would you say that these figures are a way of reflecting back on American society?
I would say so, yeah. And Chavez is just another one. By the way, it's interesting that the Chavez story emerges in the American consciousness at the same time we go into Iraq in 2003. We go into 2003. Chavez comes up, the coup. The coup is very important. It's almost as if we want to get rid of Hussein and we want to get rid of Chavez. If we had been successful with Hussein, more so, in Iraq. I wonder if Chavez would still be here.
Your film shows Chavez in a very soft and kind of flattering light. Would I get the impression that you'd like to see more Chavez types around?
I mean, I think Chavez is great. I think that in Europe, we ought to have people like that everywhere. Yeah. He's a disciplined man. He's a soldier. He gets it done. And I think people in the oligarchy in Venezuela has a real problem with that.
You're just about to start shooting on Wall Street too, and I wonder if it might reflect the view that Michael Moore's film, Capitalism, A Love Story, also has of Wall Street, where he encircles the entire downtown of Wall Street with a crime scene tape.
We hope it reflects what was going on. We deal with the big banks, absolutely. Some of our players are playing big bankers. We deal with the Federal Reserve Board. We have those. We show 2 meetings inside the Federal Reserve Board. We try to show the stakes in dramatic terms so people understand. Very tough subject. Wall Street 1 was not an easy movie because it had a lot of technical detail. But I think we kept the emotions in there. Same thing is true about this. It has to be an exciting movie.
Michael Douglas will still be in it?
Michael Douglas, Shia LaBeouf. Josh Brolin is playing one of the big shot bankers. Frank Langella from Frost Nixon is also an older banker. Carrie Mulligan from An Education, young English actress, will be the daughter of Gecko. And Susan Sarandon is the mother of Shia LaBeouf.
And so Gordon Gecko is still part of Wall Street?
No, he's an outsider. He's been in prison. He has to get back in. It's a different motive.
In a way, your film is so iconic, all these wonderful kind of details, the fashion was right, that it created a kind of iconic monster. Do you feel that you did that? Do you feel guilty in any way that your kind of iconic creations of Wall Street created a myth of Wall Street that still obtains today?
It's true. No, a lot of people did tell me they went to Wall Street because of Wall Street. That's ironic, isn't it? I thought the bubble would pop back then. I was shocked by the cycle of wealth through the 90s and the 2000s. And I think it's a condition that's not over. I think that the movie, if you really look at it, is clear. I mean, it does come down on the side of morality. I do believe in financial responsibility. My father was a stockbroker for 40 years, and I respected him. He was an honest man. Wall Street has an important role to play and can be a very constructive role in new business, in financing, in state bonds, pension plans. But, you know, it became the speculation is the mother of all evils. This is what... Anyway. There has to be regulations, and we're not getting these regulations in place.
What is it about unpopular figures that you find so attractive for making movies?
Underdogs, you know, even Nixon. I mean, I hate Nixon. I really do. And I frankly detest George Bush. And yet I made movies about them that were, I would say, empathetic, not sympathetic. I think that's part of the dramatist's approach is you try to understand the person that you don't like.
Do you think there's an element of you in the popular media that's so unfashionable, that's so attacked, that you are drawn to these figures themselves?
Of course it has. They often personalize against me, yes. But, you know, how can I be Richard Nixon and Jim Morrison? I mean, I've been accused of being both, you know. I mean, that's a hard match.
What are your feelings about the current regime and the declared war on drugs?
The war on drugs is disgusting. It's a fault war. All the Latin American presidents came out recently and condemned the war on drugs as a failure. When are we going to wake up? War on what? War on poverty, war on drugs, war on terrorism. When are we finished with war? What's wrong with Americans? Why do we love war? There was a wonderful documentary, Why Do We Fight? I mean, we have a Pentagon that is so expensive. $750 billion, you know, how do we get rid of this fucking monkey on our back? How do you, why do we have to build bigger and bigger weapons? This is a real sick economy. It's a war economy.
Oliver Stone there, and South of the Border may be on release in a cinema near you around the world sometime soon. Look out for it. That just about leaves me time to round up last week's competition. Thank you to the many of you who entered our 500 Days of Summer soundtrack competition. The question was, who's the lead singer of the group She and Him? Well, the answer is, of course, Zooey Deschanel, star of 500 Days of Summer. And She and Him are on that soundtrack doing a version of The Smiths. Please, 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 please let me get what I want. Well, the people who are getting what they want this week are Davina Sivagaranathan and Robin Boothroyd. Congratulations to you. You win a soundtrack of 500 Days of Summer. The music you've been hearing on the show this week comes from the soundtrack to Julie and Julia by Alexandre Desplat, one of the great composers of current film scores. So, all that remains for me is to say, do pick up a copy of the Observer newspaper this Sunday for my legendary Venice column. You'll find more reviews in there, including George Clooney and Ewan McGregor in Men Who Stare at Goats, and Tom Ford's debut film, starring Colin Firth and Julianne Moore, A Single Man. The verdict on those this Sunday in the Observer. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, on the terrace of the Hotel des Bains in Venice, and from my producer, Jason Phipps, cobbling it all brilliantly back together in London, it's... Arrivederci e alla settimana prossima. Ciao!